KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. John Thavis was in Rome when Pope Benedict resigned and when Pope Francis was elected. Thavis is a journalist who's covered the Vatican for nearly 30 years. He sheds light on its operation in his new book, The Vatican Diaries, a behind-the-scenes look at the power, personalities, and politics at the heart of the Catholic Church. Thavis spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on April 7th, 2013.
Wow, thank you. The Vatican's been in the news lately, obviously. These are exciting times for the Catholic Church. It has, it had a pope who resigned for the first time in 600 years. In one fell swoop, he brought the papacy into the modern world. And now it has a new pope who seems quite intent on doing things very differently, in a simpler and more evangelical way. And I was fortunate enough to be in Rome for that series of historic events. I covered the Vatican for about 30 years, and last year, my family and I decided we're moving back to Minnesota. And we moved from Rome to Bemidji, Minnesota, the first time that has ever happened in human history. I had, however, planned to go back to Rome in February to kind of dip myself back into Vatican affairs because I had this book coming out, and, you know, you have to stay close to your sources. So I arrived in Rome February 10th, and the next morning I walked into the Vatican press office, and the Pope had just announced he was resigning. And my colleagues in the press, who hadn't seen me for a year, looked at me suspiciously and said, "What are you doing here? You knew." And actually, I didn't know, but I will say the signs were there. I had been watching this from afar very carefully. When you have a book coming out, you tend to look at things differently. I had sold my book to Viking a year earlier, and they told me they were going to take a year to bring it out. And I thought, that's fine, but what if, in the meantime, something happens? What if the Pope resigns? Because I knew he had considered resignation. I didn't want him to resign too early because, for selfish reasons, that might have meant I would have had to gone back and revise the book. But I thought, if he resigned just when the book is coming out, what a perfect storm that would be. So I tracked Benedict from afar, and I noticed that last fall he had wound up his big projects. He had no big projects on his calendar for 2013. He had finished his last book on Jesus of Nazareth, and then in November, he named six new cardinals for the second time that year. And I thought, okay, he's topping up for a conclave. I mean, it's clear to me. So I emailed my friends in Rome, my colleagues, and said, do you think he might be resigning or getting ready to? And their answers, which I read back to them, by the way, when I was there recently, was, I don't know, it doesn't seem like it. And it was a case of really where, you know, being further away was an advantage. This just was not on their radar. So the Pope resigned, and when the cardinals came to Rome to elect his successor, they were in a very strange mood. I had not seen that in 30 years covering the Vatican. Many of them saw Benedict as a victim of the inept and sometimes corrupt Vatican bureaucracy. And they were openly critical of the Roman Curia. They had meetings before the conclave began, and they would march these Vatican officials up to the microphone and ask them very tough questions. And at these meetings, at one point, Cardinal Jorge Maria Bergoglio of Argentina stood up, and he gave kind of an interesting vision of the church. One that is less self-referencing, he said. One that is less focused on its own theology and more on the real world. A church that not only talks about the poor, but actually lives in solidarity with the poor. And a church, he said, that was willing to reduce the Vatican bureaucracy because he saw it as a barrier. Well, the cardinals liked what they heard from Bergoglio, obviously, as we now know. And I don't want to say I called this papal election, but 2 days before they went in to vote, my sources told me that Bergoglio's star was rising. And I wrote this on my blog. I singled him out on my blog. So, yes, I did call this election. And when the white smoke arose from the Sistine Chapel and everybody was going, who? I was doing commentary on ABC News, and he was at the top of my cheat sheet. So I felt very fortunate. Once again, very fortunate. So, in short, the cardinals came to Rome, they elected this new man, Bergoglio, and then they went home, leaving Pope Francis to navigate a world he really does not know at all. My book explains what Pope Francis should expect. And yes, I hope he is reading my book. It explains what his battlefield is going to be if he really wants to reform the Vatican. And I think my book explains why Pope Benedict resigned and why he felt so frustrated at this series of missteps and leaks and power struggles that came out into the open during his 8 years at the Vatican. I wrote my book because I was convinced that the public perception of the Vatican is a caricature. You know, the Vatican is seen as this monolithic structure, a power structure, where things are hermetically sealed, no secrets ever get out, where there's a classic kind of hierarchy. Orders come down from on top, everyone marches in lockstep. And that is not the Vatican I came to know in covering it for 30 years. The Vatican I know is a place where curia cardinals speak out of turn quite regularly, where leaks are common, where the left hand often doesn't know what the right hand is doing. It's much more decentralized than people would imagine. It's a place where lower-level officials have a surprising degree of freedom to operate and therefore to make mistakes. And they do. And these bit players often take center stage. And basically, that's what I wanted to convey in my book, to give the flavor of the Vatican, the personalities, the people who make things happen behind the scenes, and the humanness of the place. Part of this reality is that there are strong tensions pulling the Vatican apart, and I would say the biggest tension right now is between transparency and secrecy. You have the demands of modern communication, and you have the old way of doing things at the Vatican, which is the idea that everything can be hidden behind these 17-foot thick walls. We see this tension every day. You have a pope like Pope Benedict, who would speak to reporters on his plane, and then back at the Vatican, his top aides would rewrite what he said because that was the version that was going down in the history books as far as they were concerned. This was the official version. You have the Vatican launching social media projects, but none of them are interactive because they're still afraid of comments. You know, the church has been speaking in a monologue for centuries, and it's hard. You have the Pope, Pope Benedict, who declared he's taking this revolutionary step of resigning, and he announces this in Latin so that half the cardinals in the room weren't really sure of what he said, because even the cardinals today, most of them don't speak Latin. So these tensions run through almost everything that happens at the Vatican, certainly everything that happens in this book. In terms of organizational efficiency, the Vatican is largely dysfunctional, but fascinating. And this is the problem for me as a journalist and an author. It is immensely more interesting to write about a Vatican where secrets are not kept and where cardinals are too candid than about a Vatican that runs with machine-like efficiency. So while I wish Pope Francis well in his reforms, you know, I don't want him to take away all the grist for my mill as a journalist and now author. I'm going to read just a few things, and then I'll take questions. I hope you have a lot of questions, because Vatican's a strange world, and I'm happy to give you all my wisdom about it. I'm going to read from this first chapter on, actually the second chapter, on papal trips. I could have written an entire book an entire Boys on the Bus book about traveling with popes because so many weird, strange things happen. But I am going to read a section about Benedict's first trip when he seemed to set a different style. And I'll read this from the Kindle edition. As a traveler, Pope Benedict avoided the outposts of Christianity and their cultural quirks. This reflected the focus of his pontificate. After more than 25 years of church expansion in places like Africa and Asia, Benedict believed the priority was to shore up the base. It's no accident that most of his trips were to Europe. And unlike his predecessor, he seemed to have zero interest in traipsing through shanty towns, saying mass in the desert, or watching native dancers boogie to the beat during a papal mass. Benedict set the tone of his travels during his very first trip when he presided over World Youth Day in Cologne, Germany in August 2005. The highlight of these international assemblies is always an evening vigil with the Pope, followed by mass the next morning. John Paul II conducted the vigil as a kind of spiritual pep rally, listening to the youth tell their personal stories, watching them dance, and joining in their songs. He lightened the mood by kidding and cajoling, twirling his cane, tossing aside prepared texts, and generally catching the fun flavor of the event. As we discovered in Germany, that was not Pope Benedict's style. The Cologne vigil took place at twilight on a gently sloping hill as a full moon rose along the horizon. It was heavy on prayer and light on entertainment. From time to time, the crowd began chanting Benedict's name, as they used to do with John Paul II. But the German Pope put his fingers to his lips to gently hush them. It wasn't long before the chanting died out. The program included a few slow and dignified dances by youths from Ghana and India, but the highlight was silent adoration of the Blessed Sacrament, when the attention of nearly a million young people was directed to a consecrated host in a gold monstrance elevated on a papal platform. Toward the end of the evening, as a clarinet played a haunting melody, the young people lit candles and waved them from side to side, creating a moving sea of light. On the stage, Benedict held his own candle, but didn't move it. Behind him, a phalanx of Roman Curia cardinals took their cue from the Pope and remained still, like statues. All except for Cardinal Angelo Sodano, who looked up, saw the crowd, smiled, and slowly waved his candle. For singing out of tune like that, Cardinal Sodano, at time the Vatican Secretary of State, received some behind-the-back criticism. One senior Vatican official told me a few days later, Sodano looked ridiculous. He said it in a way that implied there might be some career fallout from candle waving.
John Thavis, the author of The Vatican Diaries, a behind-the-scenes look at the power, personalities, and politics at the heart of the Catholic Church. He spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on April 7th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Cameron Drews recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from John Thavis in a moment, 820 94.9 KUOW. Will retailer Loblaws promises of compensating families of victims of the recent collapse of a clothing factory in Bangladesh be fulfilled? Also, Defense Minister Peter McKay finds funds after an audit finds an emergency network in a state of emergency. And the president of Estonia on austerity and the economics operetta about his Twitter tussle with economist Paul Krugman. All these items tonight at 11. We live our lives at human speed. We experience the world on a human time scale. But how about putting ourselves through the paces for a change by peeking inside a microsecond and mastering the fastest thing in the universe. Also, a look at one of the longest-running science experiments in history and an attempt to understand the speed of high-frequency trading. It's all tomorrow evening at 7 on Radio Lab. Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight, lows in the 40s, partly cloudy. Friday highs around 70, sunny skies. Friday night lows around 50, clear skies. And Saturday highs somewhere in the 70s, sunny again.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. What happens behind the scenes at the Vatican? Journalist John Thavis has covered the Vatican for almost 30 years, and he hopes to offer insight into its power and politics in his new book, The Vatican Diaries. He spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on April 7th, 2013.
There's a chapter that ends my book called The Real Benedict, and when I was asked to update that chapter for foreign editions, I essentially, all I had to do was write, and then he resigned, because I think there's a sense in that chapter that Benedict is increasingly frustrated and increasingly comes to see that he doesn't really have the energy to carry out the papacy anymore, which is what he said at the end. In 2010, new revelations of sex abuse had prompted criticism of Pope Benedict, who, as a cardinal, had access to some of the files of the accused priests. Now, Vatican officials thought this reporting was very unfair to the Pope, and they tried to rally around the Pope in ways that, not surprisingly, backfired. I write here about a man known as the preacher of the papal household, a Capuchin friar named Raniero Cantalamessa, whose sermons were always interesting. He actually had the job of preaching to the Pope, which would be very intimidating for me. But his sermons would skip around thematically from, you know, whatever, the Old Testament to pop music to whatever he happened to see on TV the night before. So it was Good Friday. The Pope and the Roman Curia were in St. Peter's Basilica, and the papal preacher decided to take a walk through the sex abuse minefield. His approach was unusual. He suggested that the Catholic Church was being unfairly attacked, and that Jews, who know from experience what it means to be victims of collective violence, should sympathize. As Benedict and his aides sat expressionless next to the altar of St. Peter's, Cantalamessa then read a letter from a Jewish friend who said the current criticism of the Pope and other church leaders reminded him of the most shameful aspects of anti-Semitism. With that phrase, the Holocaust alarm bells went off in newsrooms everywhere. The papal preacher seemed to be comparing the programmed extermination of 6 million Jews who were innocent victims of a racist ideology to some bad press endured by Catholic Church leaders who had, at least in some cases, actually covered up sexual abuse by priests. No sooner had the Pope processed out of St. Peter's than Jewish groups around the world were protesting, and many Catholics were shaking their heads in disbelief. Pope Benedict, however, had been as blindsided by the Good Friday sermon as anyone else. Strangely, unbelievably to outsiders, the papal preacher had neglected to submit his text to anyone at the Vatican before pronouncing it to the Pope and to the world. Cantalamessa explained that no one had ever looked at his sermons ahead of time. Essentially, he had an open mic every time he spoke. And that's what I mean when I say that smaller level officials, bit players, can grab center stage because, you know, there aren't really people looking over their shoulders. There's lack of prior control to a degree that is unimaginable to people outside the Vatican. A lot of my book is about the media and how the media tries to cover the Vatican and often fails. I think the media often misreads the Vatican. Usually it conflates events. It reads too much into a line that was uttered by some low-level Monsignor or a line found in the Vatican newspaper. You know, one cardinal will say something and it suddenly becomes the Vatican says. The media hunts for sound bites in encyclicals. It sees a grand design wherever something goes wrong, and the grand design is usually not there. I want to read from a chapter titled Latinist. It is a profile of Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who was my own Latin teacher and who worked in the Vatican's Latin letters section. Foster is famous. He actually was on Bill Maher's movie Religulous. And because he's so wildly outspoken, became one of the most popular figures from that movie. The morning after he was elected, Pope Benedict celebrated Mass in the Sistine Chapel to officially end the conclave. It was the world's first look at the new pontiff, and at the end of the long liturgy, he took his seat on a beige throne and delivered a 5-page sermon. In the Vatican press office, reporters looked at each other in disbelief. The Pope was speaking in Latin instead of the usual Italian. Surely, this was a sign of something. As we scrutinized the Italian translation that was handed out at the press office, murmurs filled the room at the surprising content. Pope Benedict was announcing that the Second Vatican Council would remain the compass for the Church under his pontificate. His goal, he said, would be to build an open and sincere dialogue with everyone. He stressed his commitment to ecumenism and bridge building with other religions, as well as to the Church's effort to promote peace and justice in the world. Pope Benedict, the Church's doctrinal watchdog and conservative theologian par excellence, was taking a liberal stance in his first major address as Pope. It made for a good storyline, and we all wrote articles suggesting that right at the outset, Benedict had signaled that his papacy would not be boxed in by the expectations of traditionalists. Indeed, by outlining such a progressive agenda in Latin, perhaps the new Pope was sending a subtle signal to the Church's most conservative wing. I speak your language, but don't share your mindset. Sometime later, when I mentioned to Father Foster the importance of the Pope's inaugural sermon, he guffawed. Are you kidding? That was just a canned thing. We wrote it a week before the conclave, he said. What do you mean, I asked. They needed something to hand the new Pope, something all-purpose, got it? We had him say something about everything. It was generic. Vatican II was great, a bit about war and peace, something nice about young people, ecumenism, the whole bag. He paused and then snorted. Don't tell me you people thought this man was elected Pope one evening and pulls out a 5-page homily in Latin the next morning? Come on. I went back and reread the sermon. Sure enough, except for a few introductory lines, it was Vatican boilerplate. Surprisingly well-assembled boilerplate, though. As for the significance of the Pope's delivering his first sermon in Latin, Foster pointed out that it had always been done that way. He was right about that, too, of course. It had been a long time between popes, and reporters had simply forgotten. So that's the way journalism works at the Vatican, even for some of us so-called experts. Maybe we have time to read one more quick thing, and then I'll take your questions. A lot of people presume that the process of declaring someone a saint is a thorough process, which it is, but that it depends on a kind of secret, hidden evaluation that can only be done behind closed doors. In fact, it depends to a great degree on people who are willing to push the cause. There's politics in this. And in the case of Pope Pius XII, I discovered that one of the prime movers behind the scenes was an American nun who from time to time would come to Rome and try to light a fire under Vatican officials. This is what I wrote. The voice at the other end of the phone was gravelly, with a thick New Jersey accent. She was selling a story, something about a book she'd written on Pius XII. I'd never met her, but she was about to correct that. You better come see me, dear. This is going to be big. It was 2003, and With the debate over Pius and the Holocaust reaching a crescendo, it seemed like a good story. I went to see her at the convent near the Vatican where she was staying, a house of the religious teachers Filippini, an order founded more than 300 years ago. Sister Margherita Marchione, 82 years old, but you'd never guess it, came into the foyer, not with one book, but with a stack of various volumes, and slapped them down on the table. "There you go, darling. You've got plenty to write about now." She stood about 5 feet tall and wore the dark habit of her order, a black shawl-like affair that she tugged at as she sat down in front of me. Her graying hair was visible under a soft black bonnet, and a pair of oversized glasses made her eyes look like cannons ready to fire. She wore a continuous smile that seemed genuine. "We've got to get Pius XII beatified, Johnny," she declared. "The man was a saint." Johnny? I hadn't been called that since fifth grade. And in fact, there was something about this scene that reminded me of my parochial school education. Picking a slim, hardcover book from the pile, she continued, "This is my latest. I had to write it with the smear campaign going on against this good man. I gave a copy to the Pope the other day." It was titled simply, "Pope Pius XII," and laid out the case that the late pontiff had prudently and quietly helped Jews, opposed Hitler at every turn, and practiced the virtues of a saint. "Do you have children? They'll love this," she said, pulling out a copy of Pius XII, the children's pope, a biography in easy-to-color line drawings, along with a brief narrative. I turned to a page titled The Holocaust and read, "In Germany, Adolf Hitler killed thousands of Jewish people and others. The Pope saved many by hiding them in the Vatican and in convents and monasteries. He also provided them with money, food, and clothing." Another page recalled how Pius once found an injured bird in the Vatican gardens and nursed it back to health. It would perch on his shoulder during mealtimes, hopping down to eat from its own dish of seeds and keeping him company. "It's all true," Sister Margherita said, looking over my shoulder. "People forget what a beautiful human being this man was. How many children do you have? 3? Take one for each of them, dear." That was Sister Margherita. She's still going strong. She calls herself the Fighting Nun, still working for the beatification of Pius XII. She actually is a historian and wrote a book detailing all the convents in Rome that opened their doors to Jews. And part of the chapter of that book also takes a pilgrimage through one of these convents and talks to the nuns who hid more than 60 Jewish women and children. So Sister Margherita was not just, a partisan supporter. She actually did her homework, and she wrote a book that's considered by historians to be very valid.
John Thavis, the author of The Vatican Diaries, a behind-the-scenes look at the power, personalities, and politics at the heart of the Catholic Church. He spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on April 7th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Cameron Drews recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from John Thavis in a moment. 834 94.9 KUOW. Lawmakers and citizens are calling for stricter DUI laws. There are cottage industries built around drunk driving convictions. How will those businesses be affected by changes to the law? Do tougher laws unfairly affect the working poor? Are there affordable and effective treatment options available for offenders? KUOW's Patricia Murphy has the latest news on the topic tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Inspired by an actual espionage scandal, a French diplomat discovers the startling truth about his Chinese mistress. LA Theater Works presents M. Butterfly by David Henry Hwang. John Lithgow and B.D. Wong recreate their original roles from the Tony Award-winning production. That'll be tomorrow evening at 10. Forecast says lows tonight in the 40s for the Seattle area, partly cloudy. Friday highs around 70 and sunny. Friday night lows around 50 and clear. Saturday highs somewhere in the 70s, sunny skies. Seattle musician and band leader Wayne Horvitz talks about Beck's Song Reader, the pop star's release that consists only of printed music. He encourages fans to arrange and perform themselves. Also a look at how the practice of adapting comic books to other media extends back to the golden age of radio. And a look at the dramatic increase in the number of armed anti-government groups in Washington State. All three of these items next hour. Beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. John Thavis is a journalist and the author of The Vatican Diaries, a behind-the-scenes look at the power, personalities, and politics at the heart of the Catholic Church. He spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on April 7th, 2013. Next, he takes questions from the audience. The first question is, who does the administrative work of the Vatican?
Typically, by tradition, it's the Secretary of State. And that depends, though. I mean, the Pope is an absolute legislator, and he rules as a monarch. So a Pope can do it all. The problem is that because the Vatican bureaucracy has grown and expanded to the extent that it's hard to manage, a Pope these days generally decides, I don't even want to mess with that. John Paul II spent 15 years trying to devise some sort of reform of the Roman Curia to streamline it. Well, the Roman Curia is like a mosaic of fiefdoms, you know. Every institution there has its own history that goes back centuries, and they are protecting their own turf. And they don't necessarily want streamlining. So, as John Paul discovered, there is huge resistance to even the idea of coordinating action between all these offices. He gave up after 15 years. They did some kind of curia reform, but it was very minor. Pope Benedict, when he got in, he told his close aides right off the bat, I'm not going to try to change the way things are working here. I don't have the energy. He knew that at age 78, when he was elected, this was like a project for a much younger man, if that. So, yes, it's generally the Secretary of State. And that's why with this new pope, a guy who comes in from afar as an absolute outsider to the Vatican, it's going to be crucial for him to choose someone who knows how to navigate his way around the Roman Curia. Because otherwise, he could find himself being thwarted, I think.
What numbers are you talking about when you say the Roman Curia?
There are probably 50 major offices of the Roman Curia, if you include everything. Numbers of employees. The Vatican employs more than 4,000 people total, but in the Roman Curia itself, a lot of those are lay employees who work at the museums or the infrastructure. The Roman Curia itself, I think, is around 1,200 employees. their top officials, if you collected the cardinals and archbishops and bishops, the key people instead of just the staff, you would probably be talking about 150 to 200 people. It's actually kind of a small world. One of the things I discovered working my way around the Vatican is that their offices are almost skeletal when you consider the amount of work they have to do. There's one section of the Secretariat of State whose job it is to keep track about diplomatic affairs all over the world, and they have about 15 people there. And so, you know, every official has a brief of about 12 countries or 15 countries. And you know, there's no way they can probably do this really effectively. I was at the Vatican, as I mentioned, in February and March, and I went over to the Justice and Peace Council. And they have an immense task, too. They're trying to track economic and other justice, social justice issues around the world. They have 8 experts. That isn't very many. And in fact, the Vatican's own budget, you know, as much as the impression is that the Vatican is very wealthy, the Vatican budget each year is about $330 million. That is less than most major universities in this country, for example. And, you know, that's the universal nerve center of the Catholic Church. I have been in offices where stuff is peeling off the walls. And so although we generally see things on TV framed in these very elegant and sumptuous settings, it's not like that once you get kind of behind the walls at the Vatican. Some of these offices could really use a makeover.
The question from the audience is, what are the new Pope's plans for the Vatican Bank?
Well, my own suggestion, which I made in an article I wrote for USA Today under the title Seven Steps for a New Pope, was that they abolish it. They don't need to be in the banking business. Now, whether they take my advice, I don't know. But theoretically, the new Pope is said to be actually considering that option. I remember, yeah, I was here when John Paul, here in Rome, John Paul I died, and I don't buy that, by the way. I don't think he was murdered, although I remember I was working in Rome at the time, and I'd had a Rip and Read radio show at 7 a.m. I was working at an English-language newspaper. My job was to rip the headlines, go up, turn on the mic, and read them. And I usually didn't actually read them until I was on the air, and I see John Paul I dead, Vatican says, and I thought, like, what? He was elected a month ago. So I opened the news with that very tragic news and then pushed play music, ran down to the bar because I desperately needed an espresso before coming back. And the first words I heard when I walked into the bar, l'hanno ammazzato, which, if you know Italian, you know means they killed him. The Roman reaction is, oh, yeah, obviously they killed him. And this was David Yalop's thesis that he was murdered. I don't believe it because I also happen to know that he was a sick man. He had terrible circulation problems. He had phlebitis. He was awaiting medication to be delivered from Venice. And basically, it was a total screw-up. They could have probably kept him alive had they been a little more efficient in doing what they should have done. But as far as the Vatican Bank goes, yes, John Paul I, who reminds me a lot of Pope Francis, actually, was a simple man who said, do we need a bank? And he was looking at a serious reform. I think Pope Francis will either suppress it, and I'd love to see that happen because that would send a really strong signal, or put it in the hands of, you know, a neutral body. They have tried to reform this over the years, and I have to give Pope Benedict credit for trying. He set up, he named his own director who was supposed to institute all these new changes to make it more transparent. Benedict set up the first agency inside the Vatican to monitor all financial transactions. And I know they did because, you know, I heard religious orders complaining about it. But apparently the Vatican Bank somehow resisted. And so I think they need somebody to come in with a cudgel and basically set things right. And I think it will happen. From every indication, this new pope seems to know who's pope and that he can make these kind of decisions. Yeah.
The question is, what's your insider's take on the situation with the previous pope being so concerned that the nuns in the U.S. needed to be reviewed and investigated?
I think the nuns, the whole issue of the nuns probably was less Pope Benedict's agenda than Cardinal Frank Rode's agenda. Quite personally, I think Benedict went along with it, unfortunately. Cardinal Rode was the head of the Vatican congregation that oversees religious orders. He was convinced that American nuns had gone astray somewhere along the way, and that, you know, and I think Benedict shared the general view that the church in the modern world had adopted too much of the modern world and had to get back to the roots, which meant things like wearing the habit, but not only wearing the habit, doing the traditional things that religious orders did, running schools, for example. The original charism, it's called, of a religious order had to be respected. And so why were nuns out living in an ashram somewhere? You know, how did this ever come to be? And they wanted to roll back the clock. And they started with the American nuns, I think, because the American, you know, let's face it, Americans sort of set the agenda for everything in the world, and the Vatican's very keenly aware of that. And so they wanted to, you know, send a signal. Now, what was actually done, you know, the investigation seemed to have led nowhere, and I'm not sure that there really was ever any rollback in any in any realistic sense, it made people very much aware that a lot of American nuns in the Vatican don't see eye to eye on some things. But my own impression is that it exaggerated the differences, really, rather than talking about what they share in common, which is a lot. And so I don't think it was a very productive discussion or investigation, if you want to call it that. And as I say, the investigation seems to have gone nowhere. Cardinal Rodet is now out. Pope Benedict is now out. And they just named a new secretary of that congregation who is a fairly liberal Franciscan. And so I think we'll see a whole kind of a turning of the page on that issue.
So it's kind of a non-issue.
I think it's a non-issue right now. Yeah.
The question is, what's your read on Pope Francis so far? Is he going to be easier for journalists to work with?
Yeah, he's a lot easier. Francis is a journalist dream compared to Benedict. I mean, let's face it, Benedict was a great theologian, a very deep thinker. But every time journalists, and it may surprise people to learn this, but journalists need the Pope to be more than just a Pope. A Pope is a celebrity by default, but he has to also create a persona in order to remain in the news cycle. And John Paul II had several that were quite useful, the slayer of communism, the globe-trotting pope who went to the ends of the earth. He did enough brand-new, important things to always give journalists plenty to write about. Benedict was a very religious figure. Most of what he talked about was religious, okay, which for Catholic News Service was fine. We would always have something to write about. For AP, I can't tell you. Reuters, I can't tell you how many times I would hear, they're reading over the papal sermon. This is all religious. It's all religious. What am I going to do with this? And so Francis, seems to have a different vision of the church, as I say. Just the things he's done differently have already given journalists, plenty to kind of create a persona with for him. He is the poor man's pope. He has come in. He's living out his vow of poverty as he did as an archbishop. He's a Jesuit, remember. He's made a vow of poverty. He has refused to move into the papal apartments. Not because that makes him any more or less humble, but because basically he's less isolated. He's living in a guest house now where not everybody can walk in, but a lot of people can walk in and do. And they walk into his morning mass. They're there in the morning. He walks out and can walk around the place. And he's less protected, less isolated, and less surrounded by Roman Curia offices. So I think the press has latched onto that. And, if he starts doing things like selling off Vatican treasures, which I don't think he'll do, you will soon see the press kind of move into really high gear on this revolutionary figure of the Pope. Probably my own opinion is that the press, the media always overreacts, okay, and I'm guilty of it as anyone. But so I think when it comes to what the church is basically preaching, Francis is going to be fully in line with Benedict and John Paul II and others. I don't think we're going to see any major reversals of what the church teaches on doctrinal issues, for example, women's ordination. No, I don't think he's going to change that. The church is teaching about abortion. The church is teaching about gay marriage. He may frame the question more in a different way, in a way that attempts not to alienate audiences. But I think, anyone expecting the church to suddenly shift directions on those issues is probably in for a disappointment. But we've already seen a different style of being Pope, a simpler, more down-to-earth style. He has the common touch, and the media loves that. Yes?
The question is it correct Pope Benedict retired 10 days after your book came out?
Yes. Yes, that's pretty much true, yeah. Well, my publisher thinks I convinced the Pope to resign. The timing truly was incredible. I did not plan it that way, but as I say, I did sort of think he might resign, and I did sort of think it might be in February. And the reason for that is, it's very esoteric, very Catholic, okay? February 22nd is the Feast of the Chair of Peter. That is a feast day that celebrates really the authority of the papacy. And through history, when popes have done something interesting about the papacy, they've often chosen that day to do it. It would also then allow him to set up a conclave and a pope to be in place by Easter. So in my crazy thinking, I'm thinking, okay, February 22nd, yeah. And I'm looking past February 22nd. What does he have on his calendar? Nothing. So yeah, I plan to be in Rome February 22nd. Well, he didn't do it on February 22nd. He announced it on February 11th and then retired February 28th. So, but it was all good, you know. The timing of this has assumed mythic proportions in the publishing industry. I don't know why. I didn't think it was all that unusual or great, but I've been told, no, this happens once in a lifetime. You're the most fortunate man on earth. So I think a providential hand is guiding me somewhere.
The question is, how did the book's release affect your sources?
I think so far, I've been surprised. The reaction from people at the Vatican so far has been very positive. Of course, it's come out in English so far, and the Italian edition comes out next month, so we'll see. Not everybody knew I was writing a book. They knew because a lot of what I write in the book is based on my reporting as well and some interviews I've done over the years. So I think they all knew I was a journalist and was reporting in some way. A lot of the sources I used was on the condition that they not be named, and I respected that. Probably the one person who was most surprised is Reggie Foster, who the Latinist. I never really thought to ask his permission because he's the most outspoken character in the book, and he would go around for 45 years kind of shooting his mouth off as loud as he could within earshot of the Pope about how crazy everything at the Vatican really was. So I'm presuming he won't have a problem. But so far, so good. I haven't burned any bridges as far as I know. Yes?
The question is, how did the child abuse scandals play out in the Vatican?
There's a chapter in my book called Nuestro Padre that details the investigation of one priest, the founder of the religious order, the Legionaries of Christ. And I think that pretty well sums up how the Vatican approached this issue. The Vatican no longer tries to suppress everything. They are genuinely trying to address this issue. But they've done so on a very slow learning curve. And, you know, as in this case, it was actually Pope Benedict who, as Cardinal Ratzinger, relaunched the investigation of this guy because I think he wanted to make sure that the record was clear. And eventually the Vatican condemned him. Of course, by the time they did, he was dead and buried. And so many other revelations had come out about him that they were mind-boggling. So the Vatican acted with all due deliberate speed on issues that Americans in particular expect the Vatican to act with greater urgency on. And that's the criticism of Pope Benedict that I hear most often, along with there's one other issue that the Vatican has been, I think, rather slow to act on, and that is when it comes to accountability of bishops who have covered up cases. There have been very few bishops who have been asked to resign, and I think a lot of Catholics around the world would like to see that change. Yes?
The question is, do you anticipate any changes in the way the Vatican approaches new technologies or social media?
That's a tough one because, you know, there are many people in the Vatican right now that are pushing for transparency, right? That's the reason the Pope's on Twitter. That's the reason they've opened up other channels of a semi-Facebook page, except it doesn't allow comments. You know, there are people pushing for this. Now, and I think Pope Francis is probably open in theory to this, but he's also media shy. He doesn't like necessarily to give interviews. He likes talking to people one-on-one. He likes being with people. So I'm not sure how that's going to play out. With Benedict, we had, When he finally got around to tweeting, they had to show him how to tap instead of press iPad. You know, that was, I guess that's pretty classic for some of us people who are older, but the first time. But Benedict, you know, it was a pope who was tweeting, but he was writing out his documents in longhand still. He didn't use a computer at all. And I don't know that Francis uses a computer much either. I would guess not much. So a lot of it is how much you're online in your everyday life. That determines whether you're going to really use social media. For now, the Twitter account is still kind of a corporate account. You know, somebody else is taking what Pope Francis said and picking out a short block of words and throwing it up. So we'll see. They once opened up an email account for Pope Benedict, you know, and in order to wish him like a happy birthday or a happy anniversary or something. And there were so many emails that they quickly shut it down. They realized, number one, there's no way the Pope can actually read all these. Number two, there's no way the Pope can answer any of these, really, because if you answer one, well, then why didn't the other guy get an answer? So there are some things that kind of lend themselves to social media and other things that don't. And I don't know, they're going to have to figure that one out.
The question is, do you think Pope Francis will do anything concrete about social justice and equality?
I expect that he'll continue to make that a keystone of his whole pontificate. You know, he made a name for himself in Buenos Aires by doing these very simple things of not living in the bishop's palace and cooking his own meals, taking the subway. And he's already started along that path at the Vatican. But also, he assigned his priests in Buenos Aires to the poorer areas of the city and the archdiocese. He doubled the number of priests working in slum areas, for example. And, I mean, that's the kind of policy decision where if you take those decisions at the level of the Vatican, well, suddenly you could see big changes happening in the way the church operates. I mean, the church already operates to a large extent in the poorest areas of the world. And anybody who's been to Africa knows this is where, you know, religious orders are and where the church tends to focus a lot of its energy. But I think you could see much more. All right. You're welcome.
John Thavis, the author of The Vatican Diaries, a behind-the-scenes look at the power, personalities, and politics at the heart of the Catholic Church. He spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on April 7th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Cameron Drews recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Community of Mindful Parents, a website for information about classes like Listening Mothers and Reflective Parenting, as well as interactive conversations exploring the mindful path to stress-free, happy, well-adjusted families. Information online at communityofmindfulparents.com. 859 KUOW FM 94.9 Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Tomorrow evening, we're going to hear a program about physics and the big questions. For example, why is there something rather than nothing? In other words, how could the Big Bang have come about out of empty space? Physicist Lawrence Krauss claims we may finally have an answer to that question, though fellow physicist Marcelo Gleiser is skeptical. Also, Copernicus changed the world with his revolutionary idea that the sun, not the earth, is the center of our solar system. Hear Dava Sobel tell why this momentous discovery wasn't easy for Copernicus himself. Will we ever understand the true nature of dark matter and dark energy? Harvard cosmologist Lisa.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.